Keeneland Life's Work Project, number 5, Gus Cook. Legends to you and me. Immortals. Paragons. But to Gus Cook, they were the flesh and blood companions of his daily toil. Some were cherished friends. Others, just a pain in the butt. He worked with Natalma in Canada. Her son, Northern Dancer, in Maryland. His son, Nijinsky, at Claiborne. He was at Claiborne for 31 years that Cook ran perhaps the most potent breeding shed in turf history, having been hired as manager soon after the young Seth Hancock had taken the reins.
We had Secretariat, of course, was the hype name, you know, for non-horse people. But then we had Danzig, Mr. Prospect, and Nijinsky, Survivor, Damascus, you know. I mean, the stallions we had in that barn were just unbelievable.
Great horses and great horsemen have been the fabric of his career. Even when he first met his future wife, Cook was giving a shot to a 31-year-old Triple Crown winner, a Sunday afternoon at Stoner Creek Stud outside Paris, Kentucky. Everyone else has gone home. Camp Fleet is down with colic. And here comes a car, a bunch of girls from Lexington, and one of them turns out to be Teresa. You never know what's around the corner, whether with people or horses. Now he sits at home at Mount Carmel Farm, just a few miles up the road, his retirement sustained by pride in his 10 children. All 5 boys have followed him into the horse business, and rather more directly than did Cook himself when, having grown up on a grain farm north of Cincinnati, absorbing the interest of his father, who wrote for periodicals on agriculture as well as racing and sales.
We always had riding horses. My first horse was a former lead pony from River Downs, a horse named Billy. I loved the horse. And my dad just loved racing, and we were always at the Keeneland, at the sales or at racing, or at the old Latonia, or at a fair meet.
Formative experiences, evidently. Nevertheless, Cook likes to say that he lived in Ohio for 18 years, but grew up in the United States Marine Corps. He had just left high school. Vietnam was beginning to smoulder, and they had a Marine quota to fill the day he went before the draft board. Cook put his name down. That night, he found himself in California, standing in line, on the yellow footprints, waiting with suitcase in hand for the barber's chair.
All Faller here comes. And this, there were a lot of, not a lot, but there were some hippies in our group. I mean, I was a farm boy. I had hair like this. But, you know, I had hair down to here, you know. And it was hard on them. It was very hard. And we had one guy in our house that tried to kill himself about the second or third night. And even that was brutal. They called us out in the platoon street, middle of the night, we're in our skivvies, and the drill instructor's going nuts. He's got a bayonet. He said, the next one of you idiots wants to try this. He said, let me show you something. He said, don't you cut across here. He said, you put this bayonet in here, you take it all the way to your elbow, and you better be dead when I find you. Oh yeah, he challenged us. I mean, it was very intense.
But when he got to Vietnam, Cook understood the axiom: the more you sweat in peace, the less you bleed in war. And he's proud that his son Matthew also served in the Marines as an intelligence officer, before maintaining respect for their surname in the bluegrass at Shorehand Place. Cook's own transition between the military and the bloodstock business began with an introduction to Charles Kenny at Stoner Creek, the Dean of Kentucky Farm Managers. When Cook entered his office, Kenny had a phone in each ear.
And he told me, he said, just wait a minute. He said, I'll take you home and have my bride fix us some lunch. Well, his bride was 75 years old, Bunny. But anyhow, so he offered me a job in February. This was late January. And he said minimum wage was going to go up to $1.15 an hour.
If Cook wanted more than that, he could go and work at Claiborne. They'd pay him better, but he'd be a nobody over there. As it was, by learning under Kenny, Coke would eventually arrive at the storied farm across the creek as a somebody. He started on the feed truck, his allergies inflamed by the choking dust. Count Fleet was still around, as we already know. The old horse was terrified of storms, but he was about to retire from service, and the farm's new owners were into standardbreds. Kenny took Cook to the Indiana State Fairgrounds to see the famous trotter Neverly Pride, prompted by three thoroughbreds, set a world record at 154.8 for the mile.
This is one of the best sporting events I've ever been to. Very exciting. And we go back to the barn afterwards, because now he's coming to us. And the groom from Sweden, who had nine fingers, was holding him. And there wasn't anybody within 35 feet of him. He is a vicious horse. Got me one day. He pulled up, he had his blue jeans in his teeth, shaking them.
Exposure to standardbreds, including use of artificial insemination, gave Cook an intimate grasp of equine reproduction. And he was able to benefit from an outstanding mentor of the old school in Kenny.
Mr. Kenny was a very educated man. He taught German at the University of Kentucky. He was like a second father to me. I mean, he worked me hard, but he wanted the best for me. In fact, when it was time for me to go and move up, he offered to keep me. He was going to let me replace him.
But Cook had his heart set on thoroughbreds. And while 5 years with standardbreds might seem a long way round, it was an invaluable grounding.
Because it was so hands-on.
Right.
We didn't have a resident vet. We did so much of the animal care ourselves. You know, immersed in especially in the reproduction, you know, from foaling to, because we did all of our own foaling, you know, I mean, we had a problem, we had to take care of it. So I looked at a lot of semen over the year. I know a little bit about semen, not from the scientific standpoint, but from the point of, you know, oh yeah, here's a viable sample. And I'd take semen home with me. It shocked my mother-in-law, but I'd take semen home and sit on the counter and see how long it would live. You know, I'd get up at 11 o'clock at night and see if it was still alive, you know.
True, there was one occasion at Claiborne, years later, when this amateur know-how missed its mark. The vets weren't permitted to analyse semen with fertility insurance at issue, so a slide would instead be presented to Cook whenever a new stallion was test-bred. In 1995, the champion miler Lure arrived at the farm.
Seth was standing right next to him, and I looked in my microscope, and I looked up at him and said, "No problem here, boss." These are my exact words. He was sterile. But none of the vets could figure it out either. His semen was fine. He just couldn't stop mares for some reason.
Marines don't cry. But this one did, when he left Stoner Creek. He had, however, received an offer he couldn't refuse. From E.P. Taylor, to work with his breeding stock at Oshawa. And when he left the Ontario farm 5 years later, Cook would cry then too.
It was my kind of farm. It was, you know, gravel roads and not real fancy, but just good people. He was getting old, but so he wasn't on the farm that much. Now, but we had one main attraction for Mr. Taylor. We had his fell ponies. He loved his fell ponies. They came from England. I guess they used them there in the coal mines to pull coal, a little chubby. And he'd ride them. He might look at Victoria Park or Vice Regal, but he always looked at the fell ponies, which we thought was sort of a nuisance. But he loved those fell ponies.
At Oshawa, Cook learned a new perspective on the raising of racehorses, closer to the English manner. And in Natalma, he was dealing with one of the most important mares in the history of the breed. One Christmas, Cook was sent to Maryland to bring Natalma back to Canada to foal. She had been covered by an Arctic, so was expecting a full sibling to Northern Dancer.
It was December 23rd, sleeting, snowing, nasty. We loaded these mares up that are worth a fortune. And the drivers had had a few drinks, and we're going down the road, and they're passing each other and all this silly stuff. So the first time they stopped, I said, that's it. We're not going any farther with these mares. Of course, the driver, you know, he wants to fight and all this. I said, I don't care what you do with your truck. These horses aren't going anyplace. So we pulled in, he started drinking some coffee and started to sober up.
There were other problems down at the Maryland branch that ultimately required Cook to uproot again. Resolving those problems was not enjoyable. But at least there was an opportunity to work with Northern Dancer and also with an Epsom Derby winner he had raised as a foal, a tough little son of a gun named the Minstrel.
Northern Dancer was good. He was hard. Everybody, of course, everybody bred these great big mares to him because he was so small. So we had a breeding shed and we had a little pit in it where we could mount him easily. And he's a very good breeding horse. He was tough. I mean, he didn't like people, but he was not vicious, but just you had to watch him.
After completing his education with the little colossus who was transforming the international breed, Cook was ready to take over a stallion barn that would, in aggregate, achieve no less impact. Hancock approached him in 1977 on the recommendation of Stuart Janney, who had mares in Maryland as well as at Claiborne. Cook and his new boss were of similar age, and each sensed that the other was offering just what he was seeking.
Seth needed somebody that could handle stallions, run a breeding shed, handle brood mares, you know, do the whole thing. And I looked him in the eye and I said, Seth, I can do this. So I said, you want some reference? He said, no, I'm a pretty good judge of a man. I took the job. I never asked him what he'd pay me, and he never asked me what I wanted. We shook hands and I went back to Maryland because both of us were, it was the right thing to do.
Nijinsky, himself a graduate of E.P. Taylor's program, would become perhaps more cherished by Cook at Claiborne than any of his other illustrious charges.
He was atypical for Northern Dancer. Big, strong, a lot of bone, good temperament. I love the horse, good horse. Spent so much time with him because he had a health condition. He had lymphangitis in his right hind. Always this time of year when it got hot and humid, that leg would blow up. Levette and I worked straight through from January, the first foal, all the way through till the July sale. Then the Wednesday, he would go to Hilton Head. I would go the next Monday and go to a local lake. Well, Nijinsky somehow knew when the vet left and his leg would blow up like this. And there I was dealing with that. And not only, and of course, then we had, you know, Lloyd's of London would get involved and they'd send vets in. And then every year it'd get more scar tissue, so it'd get more severe, you know. And we spent a lot of time working with Nijinsky. He's an excellent patient.
So Cook would stand with the horse for hours, running a cold hose, one as patient as the other. The Queen of England shared his regard for this princely horse. Cook remembers her arriving, a camera round her neck, just like all the other tourists, and asking whether they would be seeing Nijinsky. Which set her apart because, naturally, everyone else wanted to see Secretariat.
I'd be going out, leaving the farm on a Saturday night at 6 o'clock, and here come a vanload of people from Michigan, you know, and I'd... We're closed. Oh, we just drove all day. We just want to see the big red horse. I said, come on. And I'd walk up there with him and show him Secretariat. That horse could load a camera. He loved to have his picture taken, you know. Most photographed horse in history, I'm sure. Never did a thing wrong. Easy to breed, you know, easy to handle, easy to keep his weight on. He was fine until he got sick. He got laminitis in his right front. Boy, that was tough. That was a hard thing to go through. We had said from day one, we're not going to let this horse suffer. And when he finally got to that point, we put him down. And then Dr. Kaufman and I went with him when we posted him. And I was there when Dr. Swerzik took his heart out. He said, you know, biggest heart I've seen. Big, big heart. I guess that was his secret.
His Claiborne tenure having lasted as long as it did, until ill health precipitated his retirement in 2009, Cook presided not only over loss, but regeneration, over the evolution of whole dynasties. He was there when Round Table, with his curious habit of biting himself, was pensioned. He saw Nijinsky cover Round Table's sister, Monarchy, to produce State, while the mating of State's daughter, Narrate, with Mr. Prospector, in turn gave the farm Preach, the dam of Pulpit.
In the day our vet got sick, the first day he went to the hospital, and he was an icon around the horse industry, State got the colic. By the time I got another vet there, and we lost her, she died before we even got her to the clinic. And I told the vet, I said, this is great. I said, Dr. Kaufman's not even to the hospital yet, and we just killed Claiborne's best mare. I said, we're not off to a good start here. She became the grand dam of Pulpit. Just keeps going.
So Cook became a fixed point, a fulcrum, as these wonderful families were spreading out. Sometimes his centrality to Claiborne seemed quite literal. Just as the tragic swale was raised right in front of his house, for instance, so Cook was at the line when he finally won the farm its first Kentucky Derby.
They just had such good mares there. Yes, the land, absolutely the land. You know, good. It's just been proven, you know, to raise good horses at Claiborne Farm. They don't crowd them. Seth is right there, just like his father was right there, just like his grandfather was right there. And it's, you know, as the saying goes, the master's eye fattens the calf. And they were right there on site, you know, watching what was going on. And we're not innovators, very slow to change. Everybody else around had an ultrasound machine before we ever got one.
In the meantime, Gus and Teresa were building a dynasty of their own. The kids all learned the ropes around Claiborne, starting out weeding and mowing until earning their chance to handle the horses too.
It's for my legacy to see my sons go on and do things I wasn't able to do. It's awesome. You know, and they're good horsemen, and they're making a difference in the business.
And that's because they were all raised to understand how everything starts with the sweat of your brow. When Cook returned from his time with the Marines, he felt he had acquired one asset that would redress any deficiency.
I wasn't the smartest one in the room, but by golly, I could outwork any of them.
As such, he treated every place he worked as though it were his own. So when the farm had success, he felt as though he owned part of that success. Not the farm itself, but its branding. Stoner Creek, Winfields, above all, Claiborne. He apologizes if any of this sounds hooky, but it's what he believes.
I outworked everybody else. I mean, not that I set out to outwork everybody else, it's just I couldn't stand it to not know what was going on. And when I would meet Seth down in the office at 6 o'clock every morning, and he'd say, what's going on? I could tell him who had the colic during the night and who had a foal, and if we lost the foal, why? I was involved. I was hands-on. I was down in the trenches, and I loved it. I wanted to know, and I would tell. I'd tell the night man. I'd tell the vet. I'd tell the foreman, call me. But I always had my farm radio with me, you know, and I didn't mind calling. I was an employee, but I watched that farm like I was a hen.